Welcome, everyone, to episode 301 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we have a lot to cover. We're going to look back on All-Star Weekend and reflect on the new Elam ending and how that went. We're also going to talk about a Cleveland Cavaliers head coach resigning, notable buyouts for the past few weeks, Kyrie Irving out for the year, what that means for the Nets, and some possible changes in the Bulls front office as well. Before we get to all of that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. Are now being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today is my very stable genius of a co-host, Morten Jensen. How's it going, Mort?
It's going well, Brian. I actually just stumbled over something here a few minutes before we actually went on to talk to each other. Apparently, Basketball Reference have gotten game-winning buzzer beater stats down now in its own section. Amazing. We need to give more shout-outs to Basketball Reference. Is like the statistical basketball bible in a way, and they are just constantly adding fun stuff. You can spend hours there every day.
I would legitimately not be able to do my job without Basketball Reference.
Correct.
Yes. Yeah.
No, me neither. They're so great. I mean, do they have a front-running man, or should we just get the whole team on the podcast?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a whole collection of stuff. There's a sports reference for every site, for every sport, I should say. So, yeah, they are a completely invaluable resource, and I could not shout them out enough for keeping that free. Good. But, I mean, honestly, they're worth the subscription if they ever switch to that model, too.
Yeah, totally. And you can even, this is the $20 thing per year or something like that. I think they have something, honestly.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I should look into that. I really want to support them. And this is not a paid advertisement, by the way. This is just me being completely in awe that they somehow managed to track down 773 buzzer beaters.
Well, it's honestly a good way to seg into our first topic, Mort, because... if some people get their way, we'll never see another buzzer beater again. So All-Star Weekend, this is the first podcast we've recorded since then. So we just wanted to hit briefly on the change to the format, the new Elam ending where they set the target score in the fourth quarter, the change to the first couple quarters where they play for charity as well, reset the score. When the announcement first came out, I remember everyone on Twitter was just like, I don't understand this at all. This makes no sense. This is too complicated. People aren't going to be able to follow it. And then, just watching the game, we were down in Florida with my wife's grandparents, who are, 80-something years old. They picked up pretty quickly. This was not as hard as it sounded on paper. It was relatively intuitive once you actually see it unfold. But what did you think, Mort, of the change in format in general?
Oh, God, I loved it. There's actually competitive basketball in the All-Star game again. What has that been since 2001, the Allen Iverson, Stephon Marbury comeback?
Yeah, I mean, for the last few minutes of some All-Star games, D-Wade breaking Kobe's nose, there's, sometimes physical play, but, Kyle Lowry is drawing charges in the third quarter. Right. I cannot remember the last time I saw a charge drawn in the third quarter of an All-Star game.
This was just fantastic. I mean, well done, NBA, for thinking outside the box. Well done, Adam Silver, for having the balls to actually do something new and say, you know what, I'm going to put it all on the line. I love that mentality. I think it's just further proof that the NBA is in good hands, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the fact that these things are just being implemented and tried out. Let's say this had been an absolute abomination. Then the NBA would have said, oh, okay, it didn't work. Let's try something else. Right. I really appreciate them just testing it out. And sure, initially when I heard about the Elam ending as well, I was just like, oh, I kind of had to wrap my head around it. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you kind of got it, you got it. Oh, okay, yeah, that actually makes total sense. You play each quarter outside of the fourth, individually, and then you still have the accumulated score in the top-hand corner. Mm-hmm. That's not forgotten, and that's just applied for the fourth quarter, and you set this marker of the plus 24 points. Makes total sense. I understand that people are slightly annoyed that Anthony Davis won it on a free throw. Mm-hmm. I get that, but that's just... I mean, look, at this point, we're just complaining to complain then.
I mean, what if you wanted it not to end on a free throw? Like, what is the solution? Because Kyle Lowry absolutely mugged him. People are saying it's like an off the ball foul. It shouldn't have happened. You shouldn't be able to end on that. But like, Kyle Lowry was switched onto Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis was wide open right near the basket. You're not going to allow him to catch the ball, like, are you going to say, like, oh, he can just catch it out of bounds and you have to run another play? Well, then the game's never going to end because you're just always going to foul guys off the ball right before they catch it and get an easy shot. Like, I didn't mind that it ended on a free throw. And I loved afterward because he misses the first and hits the second. And he gives the interview like, I was just trying to put more pressure on myself. That was great. But yeah, I mean, I loved the ending too. I mean, even the third quarter, like, the first two quarters the score wasn't close enough that that came into play at the end. But the third quarter, like, they were running plays at the end there. Like, that's where the competitiveness really ramped up, I would say. And then it just carried right into the fourth. It was just the most enjoyable All-Star game I think I've ever seen.
I mean, look, when Giannis started blocking LeBron,
oh my god,
and playing like lockdown defense,
yeah,
I'm not gonna lie, Brian, I had a semi.
Yeah, that the one block against the one that they thought was a goaltend at first, like, yeah. God. When do you see chase down blocks at the All-Star game?
I have no idea. By the way, that was arguably the closest call I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, had that happened in the playoffs, imagine the outrage regardless of what side that had gone out to?
Yeah.
Like, that was so close. I watched that replay over and over and over again. I really couldn't determine who got it first.
Yeah, no. I thought it was actually clean, but it was so close that I'm okay giving Giannis the block just because that was such a ridiculous show of athleticism.
Yeah, I mean, look, the NBA really, like, I think this format really opened up for showcasing the talent these players have.
Yeah.
Like, because when you go around and play lackadaisical and, like, it's all alley-oops and threes, I mean, to quote Shania Twain, that don't impress me much.
Yeah, and that was the first quarter. I mean,
right.
That was you get that dose of it there, and then they actually started playing real basketball.
Exactly. And that's where you really saw, like, both the competitive fire and the level of execution. The mere fact of how they were running plays and they were, drawing up things, like, they were communicating. You saw Kyle Lowry on several occasions just direct flow, like, hey, no, mm-hmm. go down to the corner. Like, in an All-Star game, are you kidding me? That's awesome. I love it. That was great. And not to be outdone, like the All-Star Saturday night.
Yeah.
With Buddy Hield winning the three-point shootout on the last attempt was gorgeous. And then you had, the slam dunk contest was unfortunate in its ending, and I'm blaming Dwayne Wade for that forever and ever and ever.
Oh, yeah.
But that was fun, though. Like, I don't agree with the people who say that it was the best dunk contest of all time. I think they are ignoring what Zach LaVine and Aaron Gordon did like 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But it was up there.
It was absolutely up there. Yeah.
I mean, that's indisputable.
It's the best dunk contest since that one, for sure.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And like, if we look at it from an overall perspective, like, it has to be in the top 10, if not top 7 even. Like, it was absolutely great. Absolutely. Yeah. So, kudos for a very entertaining All-Star weekend. And even though the Rising Stars Challenge was pretty boring, as it usually is, we still had that Luke and Trey moment, which is like forever instilled in my heart now.
Yeah. One question, or I guess two questions about the Elo ending before we move on. One, do you think the competitiveness this year was motivated by Kobe? And do you think it's going to carry over next year?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, to be honest, I hadn't really thought about it in that way. In terms of the competitive level, I definitely think that players gave it a little bit something more just in terms of this weekend being dedicated to Kobe in a way.
Sure.
No, I think this can carry over because at the end of the day, these are basketball players who play this sport for a living, and yeah, they are insanely competitive. You wouldn't be at this level if you weren't. Like, you could take the most lazy ass NBA player of all time. Like, he still has, whoever that is, would still have
Andrew Drummond. Hassan Whiteside. Not to name names.
You know, I actually don't include those guys in that. But okay. I mean, fair enough.
James Smith.
I was actually thinking someone like Ricky Davis.
Okay. Oh yeah.
But even then, like, to make it to the league,
yeah,
like, you still have to be insanely competitive. So yeah. I think it's going to carry over, assuming, you know, that the setup is the same and you still have, you know, something on the line. I would love to see, even, look, I'm not looking a gift horse in his mouth. I still think, you know, the money, the $100,000 a quarter, mm-hmm, and all that, that's great. That's really, really great. I would be up for the NBA increasing that amount.
Yeah.
Though. That could be fun. Like, put it, like, if you put $1 million on the line for each quarter.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be great. Just, yeah, and not just for the entertainment aspect, but just for a charity getting $1 million. Like, that
right,
would be
totally,
that would be fantastic, right?
Yeah. And I do wonder, yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I think it's just, if you put competitive people in a situation where there is a close score late in a quarter and they know they have something to play for, they're going to play harder. And if you, right, you know, when that third quarter money rolled over and all of a sudden it's $300,000 on the line in the fourth quarter, oh, okay, now we're going to play hard. And then, you know, when Team LeBron, I think they were down 9, I want to say, heading into the fourth. So they know, you know, we've got to outscore this team by 9, where we, you know, we're down 9, we got to reach this score, so we have to outscore them by this many points, you know. And there's no time, we just have to do it. So right, yeah, that was cool. Honestly, the fourth quarter, you know, my only reaction when I heard the news about the Elam inning was like, oh, 24 points in the All-Star game, it's gonna take 6 minutes, like, you know. But it actually lasted much longer than I expected, and I would venture to guess it lasted longer than any of the coaches and players expected, because if memory serves correctly, they did not switch lineups at any point. Like, I think it was not the starters for both, because Kyle Lowry and CP3 were in there, but, like, I think they used the same five guys throughout that entire quarter.
I actually did not pick up on that.
I think they did. I could be wrong. It was definitely at least, like, most of the quarter. So
that's interesting. I know they shot, like, horrible percentages in the final quarter because of the additional defense, or right, the increased defense, which I really appreciated. No, you're right. It did seem like it lasted a long time and not just the six-minute stretch that people were fearing. And that's, again, the competitive juices come out. And no, it was a win. It was an absolute win. I loved how people, like, took that game and said, you know what, if the NBA is going to implement, like, the cup system,
yep,
then maybe shake up the rules and make it an Elam ending in some way.
That was my other question. If the NBA does elect to expand this, I mean, the G League is obviously a fertile proving ground for rule changes in general.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, especially that was the thing that jumped to mind for me. Like, if you do this in-season tournament, you have to differentiate it in some way to make people, to make fans care. Because, you know, we talked earlier this season, like, okay, throw $1 million per player, the players will care. You know, if you give a team a draft pick, the team will care. But, like, how do you get the fans invested? Oh, okay, change the rules, make it such that, you know, you see this Elam ending and, like, you get that sort of playoff competitiveness in the regular season. You know, so would you like to see them go that route?
Yeah. And shout out to basically the G League as well, as you just alluded to. That is, like, you know, some sort of mad scientist laboratory at this point for the NBA, which is great because you can test stuff out. No, I think that would work very well. I was actually thinking about it when someone brought it up. I don't remember because it's on Twitter. Like, no one is anonymous, but when you have so many different takes, I just, mm-hmm, I can't keep track of who said what. I'm so bad at that. But the idea here was to just, like you said, separated. So I kind of went on with that thought. If you were to install this cup system, I would not only implement the Elam ending, I will also differentiate it from a visual perspective. Like, you have, every team would have different uniforms. Like, they would have specific uniforms made for the cup system.
Oh, that'd because be
that
cool.
way, you also visually, like, separate it into its own entity. Yeah. I think that could be so cool, just to have, like, an alternate version of the NBA in the cup mm-hmm. system. And then going back to, like, the regular thing that we know during the regular season. I think that yeah. could be so much fun.
And Lord knows every team has, like, six different jerseys already. It wouldn't hurt the league to come up with another one.
Right. Just add one more. Like, and you know, that's more revenue for them. Like, yeah. if they come up with something as dope as the Miami Heat's, you know, vice yeah. jerseys, like, yeah. I'm okay with that. Like,
as long as it's not the Mavericks vomit green, don't try to replicate that, please.
You know what? It's so funny. People hate that. I actually like that one for some
reason.
Do you
really?
I don't know what it is. Look, I get it. When I saw them the first time, before they were implemented on the court, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, no.
Yeah.
But maybe I'm just so head over heels about Luka and Porzingis that when yeah. I watched them play, I was like, oh, yeah, that's beautiful. Maybe it's the play I find beautiful.
I think that's it, because the jerseys are atrocious. All right. On that note, let's head to the other big news from the week. I guess this started to trickle out during the All-Star game. Woj reported that John Beilein was considering stepping down as the Cleveland Cavaliers head coach. 3 days later, he did so. And from what I saw, he gave up a guaranteed $12 million to get out of the deal. So JB Bickerstaff has taken over as the head coach for now. Beilein is being reassigned to a different role in the organization. I have not seen what that role is. Have you?
I have not, no.
Yeah, I don't know what it's going to be. But what did you think of... this guy signed a 5-year deal this summer. Like, you know, it was not supposed to be this half a season marriage. So did this catch you off guard?
No, not at all. And not just because of the whole thug/slugs situation, which was very unfortunate. No, when he signed with the Cleveland, you know, you and I talked about it on this podcast, and we were both pretty skeptical mm-hmm. of a guy who'd spent his entire career in college in the way that Beilein had, like how he would make that transition, especially at his age. And that's not being ageist, but I mean, let's just face facts. When you are older and you've been used to a certain system for, you know, however many years, you know, there is going to be an adjustment period, a significant adjustment period, and you will have to maybe increase your perspective on things. And mm-hmm. as we all know, old people aren't necessarily as inclined to switch perspective on certain things. Like, that's not, and I'm not saying that is automatically should be applied to Beilein, mm-hmm. but in this case, it proved true. Like, all the reports that came out was he was almost shocked about the way the NBA operated.
Yeah,
where I'm like, dude, if you just paid a little bit attention to the NBA, you'd know. This is a players' league. What did you have in mind? What did you expect when you came in? I mean, mm-hmm. and he came in, you know, guns blazing, you know, basically running it as a college program, and you cannot do that. This would be similar to, like, even if Mike Krzyzewski took over an NBA team after, you know, being at Duke since the beginning of time. He would also have to make adjustments because on campus, a coach is the big deal. He's the one mainstay. He's the superstar.
Mm-hmm.
That is so not the truth in the NBA. Like, that is, like, the coach there is the fall guy, if anything. So, you know, it was just a miscalculation all over. And I was sort of surprised that Kobe Altman actually signed him to begin or hired him to begin with.
Yeah.
If you want to look at it on the bright side, it didn't last years.
Yeah.
Like, it was a thing that just kind of happened, and then it goes away, and they can regroup. Is it a wasted year? Yeah, probably, but at least it's not 3 wasted years.
Right, right. I mean, yeah, that's...
What a silver lining.
I mean, it's true, though. If you're, you know, because the Cavs are still in the very early stages of this rebuild, so, I mean, you still don't know what you're getting out of Sexton Garland. Could those guys fit? Where does Osman fit in? Where does Larry Nance fit in? How does Drummond work in all of this too? So yeah, I mean, if you're if you feel like eventually, and I guess apparently they hired Bickerstaff as part of an eventual succession plan with Beeline, according to Woj, and I think Shams and Jason Lloyd, they have the Athletic had the whole big thing about what went wrong here. I believe
it's so great that you have a backup plan for your initial hire immediately. Like you already have a contingency because you know there's a risk there.
Right, right. I mean, I feel like the Lakers did that with Jason Kidd and Frank Vogel as well, but this one, that is the polar opposite of how this one worked.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's not great.
Just, no. I think you're right though. It's good to just admit it's not working. And from the sound of it, I mean, there was apparently Beeline's son stepped. He had a head coaching job that he stepped down from before the season even started, and that was weighing heavily on him. It sounded like Beeline himself was just effing miserable. And right. Like to step away from $12 million because you hate your job so much, like. For his sake, I'm glad he's out, because like if you hate your job that much, like no amount of money is worth it. Even, you know, $12 million, like you must really be absolutely in a dark, dark place. So like I'm glad he is out and can get the separation he needs, and like hopefully things are better for both parties.
I agree. So here's the thing. I have not looked into that situation at all, but I found it curious that he was so affected by his son's resignation. Is there anything bubbling under the water in that resignation that I don't know about?
I'm not entirely sure. I don't think I've heard anything.
No.
In that regard, but
it just caught me off guard because, like, you know, if someone resigns, like, okay. Like,
right.
That doesn't necessarily mean you have to. Yeah. No, but apparently it weighed on him. So maybe something happened, which, you know, unfortunate. So,
yeah.
This was just the best thing for everyone. And also for Beeline to maybe be able to separate himself from the aforementioned, you know, thugs, slugs
thing. Yeah. Like, yep.
You know, the longer he had been in that coaching role, the longer that would have been brought up. So definitely. Maybe just being able to say after half a season, you know what, I'm outie. That's fine.
Yeah, well, the Athletic report said, I think it was them, that, they said multiple players after that began playing songs that included the word thug whenever he was around, including Thuggish Ruggish Bones by Bone Thugs and Harmony and Thug's Mansion by Tupac. So
that was definitely the Athletic, because I read that and I was like, man, that's great. More Tupac into my life, please.
I know. It's just, oh. And then the Athletic was also the one that said, which he denied quickly, but Drummond said the situation in Cleveland was worse than in Detroit and would factor into whether he picked up his player option next season.
Right. So yeah, that Drummond, was a weird one because, you know, I think it was Jason Lloyd who came up, that sounds wrong, but reported that.
Yeah.
He's usually not wrong. Like right. He's pretty plugged in. So for Drummond to come out and basically say, I never said anything like that, that's a lie, seemed a little bit like damage control to me.
I would agree with that.
From Drummond's perspective. Or maybe it's just a matter of getting your wires crossed. I mean, look, miscommunication does happen in this business.
Yeah, sure.
So,
sure.
Yeah. But either way, it's just good for everyone to be able to say, let's move on.
Yeah. So where do you think the Cavs go from here? Do they stick with they'll stick with Bickerstaff, I would assume, throughout the rest of this season. Do they make him their permanent head coach moving forward? Do they look outside? What type of guy should they be looking for? Clearly, Beeline was not the answer.
Right. I think they should wait. I mean, Bickerstaff is there right now. Give him a chance.
Yeah.
And then if the team loves him, hang on to him. If they don't, move on. I it's pretty simple, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, especially after this year, who knows, you know, Brett Brown, unless a miracle happens, is going to get fired at the end of the season, I think. And if you're looking for a guy who could put up with a lot of losing and can set a positive culture despite organizational dysfunction, I don't know that you're going to do better than him.
No, you're not, but I don't want that for Brett, to be perfectly honest with you.
I don't either.
I think he's gotten such a raw deal in the NBA. Yeah. To imagine him going to a team where he has to suffer more through more losing and seeing his winning percentage further decline. Mm-hmm. Like, people in 20 years are going to look at Brett Brown's, you know, record and go, why was he ever employed for so long? He was horrible, which is such a shame, because that dude knows the game.
Yeah.
He is such a smart coach. I mean, personally, if he got fired, you know, I think there should be at least 20, 25 teams out there immediately, like, looking inwards and going, are we happy with our guy? Are we?
Right. Well, and I mean, Mike D'Antoni, too, is probably out of there in Houston if they don't make a run. I don't know. You know, for Cleveland's perspective, I think you need a guy more like Brown than D'Antoni. Like, I think D'Antoni is good for, okay, we've got star talent. I think he and Morey are actually a great fit together. Like, just an innovative coach, an innovative GM. Let's push the envelope and let's make people rethink long-held beliefs about the NBA. We need a center? Do we? I don't know. Let's see. Let's experiment. Whereas Brown, again, it's, you know, he's got the experience building a program from the ground up, which is basically where the Cavs are starting from at this point.
Right.
I don't know that you would necessarily want to draw upon him as, you know, the hybrid coach GM that he temporarily filled in after Brian Colangelo's resignation in disgrace.
Well, did he do a better job than Elton Brand?
Probably.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, even still, I just think the way he could set, and I'm not saying he's necessarily the only person or the right person that they could go after, but I think that's the type of person they should be looking for. Someone who's aware of what he's stepping into, like aware that this is going to be a long process. Free agents are not coming to Cleveland. Cleveland sacrificed its cap space to get Drummond. So even if free agents wanted to come to Cleveland, which they do not, Cleveland doesn't have the money to sign them this summer. You know, you're going to flip Kevin Love at some point, but you're going to deal with a grumpy Kevin Love until you do. You're going to have to possibly deal with Drummond for the next 5 years. Can you get the most out of him? Can you motivate him? So finding that type of guy, and Beeline, I think their rationale for hiring him is, all right, this guy works with college kids. We basically have a bunch of college-age kids on our roster. He's an innovative offensive mind. Great. Let's see if that can come to the NBA. But as you said, he had kind of a culture shock where he just didn't – his dictatorial style works in college because that's how it – I mean, that's what a lot of college coaches do. But once you're an NBA player and once you're making millions of dollars, you don't have to put up with that like you did when you were in college and you're an indentured servant, basically. Right. So that's the problem with, I mean, you know, you could go the college coach route again, I guess, but I feel like getting someone with NBA experience, but someone who's been in a place where you've suffered through some losing seasons, you know, you could set your expectations accordingly, and you just have to, it's all about the culture. It's just, you have to build this from the ground up and know that until you have that culture in place, you're not going to be able to attract the talent that you need unless you get super lucky in the lottery.
And we're going to return to talking about culture in our final segment later on.
Yes,
I just want to note one thing, even though I totally agree with you that Mike D'Antoni is not the guy to hire for that program.
Mm-hmm.
Just selfishly, could you just imagine Mike D'Antoni being hired and unleashing Colin Sexton and Darius Garland? I understand defensively there would be severe issues, but offensively, that could be so much fun. Like, he could turn them into, like, a top five league pass team off of those two. Like, he would find a way for those two to average 25 apiece.
Oh, for sure.
That could be so fun.
It would definitely be fun. I just...
Oh, yeah, no, I agree with you.
I'm just saying
from a purely selfish entertainment angle, that will be fun. That will be fun.
That is fair. All right, Mort, let's go into some notable buyouts that have happened in the last week or so. The two biggest ones, I'd say, are Reggie Jackson got a buyout from Detroit and is heading to the Clippers, and Markieff Morris also got a buyout and is heading to the Lakers. So he is both Morris brothers are in Staples Center, just on different teams.
That we know of. They can switch around. We have no idea.
That's true. Let's talk Jackson first. How much do you think he helps the Clippers?
Yeah, it depends on how much he's going to play. I think here in the regular season, with the team, you know, injury managing Kawhi mm-hmm. Leonard, and with Paul George also missing games here and there, and Patrick Beverley in and out of the lineup, you know, I think he's going to get some minutes. Hopefully for them, they're not going to need him as much when the playoffs roll around. Mm-hmm. But he's such a wonderful security blanket to have. If you have a guard that goes down, like, this isn't some, you know, 35-year-old minimum player who would be coming in and, you know, relieving that guy who's gone down. He would be a guy who's, like, in his prime, have started numerous years in Detroit and has a pretty stellar track record of running a basketball team. He would come in with a confidence level and he would be used to that role, like, of playing many minutes. So I think he's a luxury, but at the same time, he could prove crucial down the line if, you know, injury... if injury hits them.
Yeah. And I mean, we've said for most of this season now that, you know, they need... I mean, need is a strong word, but one of their weaknesses is having an additional playmaker off the bench. Like, you got Lou and Montrez who can run that pick and roll in their sleep, but, you know, they lack that type of traditional point guard. Like, Patrick Beverley isn't quite that. Reggie Jackson is. So I think in that regard, he helps to some extent, but as you said, it's a question of how much he plays. I honestly think the biggest help that he provides is not going to the Lakers, because he would have been a clear upgrade over Rajon Rondo. And I'm sure the Clippers and Lakers are eyeing each other. I mean, they've been playing chicken for months now, especially, you know, with the Marcus Morris trade talks as well. Like, they know that they're each other's biggest threat, I think, in the West. Yeah. I mean, Denver, Utah, Houston are all lurking as well. But, like, they're gearing up for, we are probably going to meet at some point in the playoffs. Like, we do not want the Lakers to be able to get this guy who would really help them out, you know, because they're getting just annihilated in non-LeBron minutes. You're not going to have as many of those during the playoffs, but you're not going to ask LeBron to play 48 minutes a night in round two. So there are still going to be some. So I think that's probably the biggest asset is what he deprives from the Lakers. That said, the Lakers they just doubled down on size instead. And now they have Markieff Morris to throw out there as well. You know, LeBron, Anthony Davis, the two centers. So now they are just going to bully ball you to death, basically. What impact do you think Markieff makes with them?
Well, I think it could be significant, assuming he gets the minutes. There was a report out saying that Kyle Kuzma is going to be playing more of a wing now, which I think is interesting. There's been some Lakers fans have basically been clamoring for Kuzma to be moved down to the three for a while. You know, personally, I think Kuzma and Markieff are pretty much fours, and even Morris is actually more of a 4-5 at this point of his career.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they can make it work. Like, LeBron is such an abnormality in terms of being a basketball player who's 6'9 to 70 or whatever the hell he is. Right. And can play virtually every position on the floor. So I think positions is a secondary in this instance. Just trot him out there. He's a guy who can get hot. He's a guy who can space the floor. He's got some fire to him. Like, he's a tough guy. I think the problem is in the locker room. Again, much like with Marcus Morris, the other way. Like, the Mariah have not exactly stellar track records as being teammates.
Mm-hmm.
So that counts for something. But again, when you have LeBron and you have AD, those two guys are presumably the ones who set the tone. Sure. So if Markieff is out of line, like, LeBron is going to handle the business.
Mm-hmm.
If he can just stay within himself, I think that's the biggest thing. Like, Markieff shouldn't be going out and, like, dribbling his way into fadeaway jump shots and do all the things that he basically could in Detroit, even though he wasn't really that successful of it. Like, he just needs to be a spot-up shooter and be a utility player more so than trying to be the guy. Mm-hmm. If he accepts that and becomes that, then that's a excellent signing.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the similar to how Jackson's biggest help might not be going to the Lakers. Markieff's biggest help might not be going to the Clippers, because the other big weakness for the Clippers, we say, is they're somewhat undersized. A bigger team could take advantage of them on the glass. And just, you know, as we saw with the Sixers right before the break, they don't have anyone who can stop you if you just throw the ball into a seven-footer. Right. Markieff at least has the size to have helped mitigate that to some extent. So had the Clippers added Markieff, that takes away one of the Lakers' biggest advantages over them. So, again, it's kind of a game of chicken.
To be fair, he's exactly the same size as his twin brother.
Yeah.
Who they also got.
But, I mean, Marcus is that. I'm sure the size is what attracted them to Marcus. Yeah. Like, now they can have, you know, they could have had a lineup with, like, both Morai, Kawhi, Paul George, and whoever, Montrez, whoever. Like,
oh, God, then, that would have been disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, they just would have had more, a greater number of bigger bodies to throw around.
Right.
That
right,
now
right.
They do not. So, and meanwhile, the Lakers just got even bigger. So I'm not predicting how that series would go. I'm not saying like either one of those guys is going to swing the series, because I don't think that's the case, but I think both of those guys would have helped the other team probably more than they'll help their current teams.
Let me just read you the depth chart of the Clippers, okay? Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, Lou Williams, Montrezl Harrell, Landry Shamet, Marcus Morris, Patrick Beverley, Reggie Jackson, Jamichael Green, Ivica Zubac. I mean, just that. And yeah. there are a lot of guys there, like Magruder, Patterson. There are guys.
Yeah.
But that core, or that rotation, that primary rotation, that is filthy.
Yeah.
I agree with you that size, like, they don't have great size there. But at the same time, we're all praising Houston for going sizeless.
Right. Yeah, it might not matter.
It might not matter, ultimately. And I will say, you know, the Clippers still have greater size than the Rockets do. So, yeah,
for sure.
I mean, right. Just by the sheer presence of Harrell, and even Paul George, who's like 6'10". Like,
yeah.
That's just way more. But, no, I am all in on the Clippers and Bucks in the finals, pending health. Like, that boils down to it, right? It's the health part. If Kawhi was healthy and Paul George was healthy, I wouldn't even consider the Lakers as an option. And I get that is insulting to some Lakers fans. I'm sorry. It's not that I don't love your team. I think they're tremendous. But look at that combination of depth, talent, you know, two-way play. Like, you can just keep trotting out scores for the Clippers, and defense and rebounding. Well, they need a little bit of rebounding, but they have everything. Everything.
Yeah.
No, God, I mean, this buyout market has been good for quite a few teams. And I'm guessing, because I'm reading the outline right now, that your follow-up question is, does the NBA need to change how buyouts work?
Indeed, because, I mean, that has been a topic I've seen. You know, I have not been on Twitter much this week, admittedly, but when I've been on, I've seen a couple people just kind of griping about how this has worked. Like, you know, I would say the Morai, Reggie Jackson, those are some bigger named players than we're used to seeing on the buyout market. I mean, you know, we haven't, like, Kanter in years past, and Belinelli, Ilyasova a couple of years ago that helped the Sixers. But, like, most of the time, the guys on the buyout market aren't actually very useful, helpful players. Like, this year, I think there are at least some guys who could make a difference to some extent. Not, like, again, not swing a series, but, like, are productive rotation players for playoff teams. Like, these teams got better without having to give up anything.
Right.
So do you think, like, the NBA needs to, I don't know, change the buyout deadline before the trade deadline, or, like, make, you know, if you get bought out after February 1st, you're not eligible for the playoffs, or are you good with it as is?
Sort of. So I have an idea, and here's the thing. I'm pretty sure that Tom Siller has brought this up, because Tom Siller's been all over this over the past couple of years. So he's brought up virtually every idea that is out there in terms of, like, the buyout market. Mm-hmm. But if he hasn't, I'm going to take credit for this.
Okay.
I think there should be more financial penalty is the wrong word. I think the team that gets the player who's being bought out should somehow have some more, you know, financial. I think it should pay out more money is basically my overall point. And here's how I'd do it. I would basically make the buyout a contract in and of itself, sort of a pseudo trade without it actually being a trade. So let's say, you know, Markieff Morris and the Lakers. Let's go with that route. Let's say, you know, he's talking to the Pistons. They aren't going anywhere. They're not interested in having him on the roster. And they're like, hey, let's find a way to buy you out. And he goes, yeah, let's do so. Where do you want to go? Well, I want to go to this team. Well, okay, let's contact this team. And it's the Lakers. And the Lakers go, yeah, we like this guy. We can set something up. Mm-hmm. And it's not a trade, but like, let's say half the amount that he's getting bought out for, the Lakers will have to pay that or something along those lines in that season. It won't go on the cap, but it would go on their payment. Like, they would have to pay it. Yeah. So there would be, like, I understand for teams that earn a lot of money, they would just say, sure, we'll eat it.
Right.
But not everyone would. Like, Tillman Fertitta.
Yeah, right.
Would he do that? I'm not sure he would. Mm-hmm. Like, just make sure that the team who ends up with this player pays a little bit more than the minimum contract.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how it should be structured. Like, that's for the NBA to decide. That's not me. But I just think there should be more of a financial burden on the team that gets the better player, because that just makes sense.
Yeah, I don't hate that. I mean, I'm honestly, like, ambivalent about it, because, you know, I think a lot of people will bring up, like, who's the last buyout guy to make a significant impact on a title team? It's been, you know, almost 20 years at this point. That said, like, I brought up Kanter, Belinelli, Ilyasova. We have seen guys who did make a difference. Like, Portland doesn't get to the Western Conference Finals last year without Kanter, because especially after Nurkic went down.
Which is saying something. I mean, look, like, think about what you just said. Like, we don't usually associate Enes Kanter as a difference maker.
I know, but your starting center goes down and you can suddenly get, you know, a productive rotation center. So
it was crucial.
Yeah, so honestly, like, I get, if you're talking about is this fair in terms of parity, no, because most of the guys that get buyout are going to be in pure ring chasing mode at this point.
Correct.
So, like, the rich are only going to get richer, and if you're a fan of the Nuggets or the Jazz, you're like, what the hell, man? Like, the Lakers and the Clippers weren't rich enough already. Like, you're going to give them Reggie Jackson, Markieff Morris. I can understand the frustration, especially from a small market perspective, but from just a fan of the game perspective and I just want to see good playoffs perspective, you know, if I get a better version of a team that is already good, I'm going to enjoy that viewing experience that much more. And if Marcus Morris or Markieff Morris costs one of those teams a game with boneheaded shot selection in the fourth quarter, which I think is very within the realm of possibility, then all the people complaining about the system right now are going to be thrilled in 2 months. So, I don't have any strong feelings either way.
I do think it's something the NBA needs to monitor. And I do think they need to talk about it, which I'm sure they are. I'm sure that there are some ideas in place, as there usually are, to just basically limit the market for certain teams. Because, yes, you're right. The big markets are huge draws when they're good. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't even make sense when you really think about it. Like, you know, Reggie Jackson, I understand the argument was he would have a greater role in LA, for example.
Right.
But there are numerous teams where he would have potentially a greater role. Even Milwaukee, like, here's the thing. Milwaukee has been criticized for not having this bench playmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hello, Reggie Jackson.
Yeah.
Right there. Like, he would solve a need as well. He would probably be getting consistent playoff minutes.
Or Philly, if they decided they wanted point guards for a change.
Philadelphia. That's a better example, actually. Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is something there where you're kind of looking at a team that are right there and going, why not them? Mm-hmm. You really want to ride Pine for the vast majority of the playoffs?
Right.
Just to win a ring? But I get it. It's a ring or bust situation. I understand it. Although, to be perfectly fair, Reggie Jackson choosing Milwaukee would probably have put him in a more advantageous position, but that's correct. Just me.
Yeah.
No, I do think that if it needs a shakeup, I don't think it needs to be a drastic shakeup.
Yeah,
it just needs to be amended a little bit.
Yeah. Maybe do like a... I don't even know. I mean, this... I don't know if this is fair or possible, but do something like a biannual exception for buyouts. Like, you're only limited to... You can only get one buyout player, and you can only do it every 2 years or something like that.
Oh. I like that. I like the idea of it. You may have to tinker with it a little bit, but I like the premise of it.
Yeah. Or maybe you get one per year or something, just so you can't get, like, four impact players. But, again, if we'll see what happens this year. In all likelihood, this is much ado about nothing. And, like, none of these guys...
Or if you want to get a buyout player every year, like, let's say contractually you're limited to one every 2 years, but if you want one every single year, you will need to sacrifice the second round draft pick.
Hmm. Well, what would happen to that pick? Just you have to give it to the team that bought the player out?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, that's interesting.
Then you give up an asset. Like, then you actually sacrifice an asset, you know, a future asset for something of the now. Like, you, because then you're basically putting, you know, your money where your mouth is by saying, you know, we're going for it right now and we're willing to sacrifice something. Like,
yeah. And also, just a reminder that teams don't have to buy players out. Like, they're doing it as a favor to them and to stay in favor with their agents. But if teams are really upset about this, they just, you know, if they wouldn't buy these players out and let them walk to contenders. They would just say, all right, if you wanted to, you know, all right, Lakers, if you really wanted this player, you should have traded us a pick for him. We would have given him to you, but, you know, you didn't, so we're just going to keep him. So,
but you know why the Pistons did it, though. They heard me talking about Christian Wood for so long, and they were like, okay, you know what? We hear you. You're right.
It's
a time. Like, I mean, look, I said he was the second, he would be the second best forward on the team. Now he's the best.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they have a G League roster, so yes, he is. Yeah.
Well, that doesn't matter.
The point is,
I was right.
He's been good. I mean, I don't think you could necessarily bank on them trading and or losing all of their other forwards, but I will give you credit where credit is due. I am very mad that I did not get him in time. I should have picked him up in fantasy like the day before the deadline, knowing that
you can't say you didn't have any warning, because I told you. I told you repeatedly.
All right, boy, let's go to the Brooklyn Nets now. We have Kyrie Irving, who has been in and out of the lineup all year with this shoulder issue. He is now out for the rest of the season, they announced before Thursday's game against the Sixers. Their record without Kyrie is better than their record with Kyrie this season. So that is something to chew on. They are currently the number 7 seed in the East. They have a 5-game lead over the 9th seeded Wizards with, looks like they still have 29 games left. So the Wizards are still technically in striking distance, but not particularly. I mean, it would take a massive collapse for the Nets to miss the playoffs.
I want to bring up that podcast where you're like, the Wizards are going to be the worst team in the NBA this year.
Oh, and I was actually looking... Sorry, I was looking at old standings. Now they are 5.5 games ahead, and they are 27 games left. So even less time for the Wizards to make up ground.
Well, even so, remember when you said it was going to be the worst team in the league? Remember that, Brian?
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah, I was not banking on the Warriors being the worst team in the league. I'll say that much.
No, but I mean, at least Washington's been entertaining.
They've been much more fun than I thought they would be.
Yeah. That's also why I want them in there instead of Brooklyn. I just want fun basketball. And with them, with Brooklyn losing Kyrie, which is, it's such a blow. Yeah. You know, it's, I get that they were better without Kyrie. I get it. But when you have that type of talent in the playoffs, especially, that's just, that's a huge loss. And, you know, our guy, Caris LeVert, he's not been healthy himself, which unfortunately isn't news. He just seems to have one of those careers. But even when he's been healthy, like he's been struggling from the floor. He's had good games here and there sprinkled out over the course of the season, and he's still a guy I think can turn into something. But, man, it's not been a pretty year in Brooklyn overall. I think Spencer Dinwiddie's been outstanding. I think he deserves a lot of credit. And I love the way that they tried to build it up over the summer, but they probably need to tinker with it just a little bit next summer.
Yeah.
Because this roster right now is... It's not exactly, you know, inspiring. When Garrett Temple is constantly one of your best players out there, that's I think that's a problematic.
Yeah, so, I mean, because regardless of how far, they're not going to get past the first round this year, right? I mean, they're...
Right.
Yeah. So we need to now look ahead, because this was never about this season for the Nets. Like, they were always likely to tread water around 500 with Kevin Durant out, but then, you know, signing these two guys was always about next year. Does this affect your view of their upside next year, knowing Kyrie has now missed a ton of time and, you know, a number of recent seasons, that KD is coming off the Achilles, which is obviously not a particularly easy injury to come back from? And like, what do they need to do? I mean, Kyrie famously in mid-January was talking about, you know, how they needed more help. And we, at the time, we were thinking like, oh, well, you're getting Kevin Durant next year. Right. Prayers answered. You're fine. Do you think they need to make bigger changes, whether that's, you know, I think Joe Harris is their only notable free agent this year, but, you know, Dinwiddie, LeVert, Jared Allen, do you think any of those guys should be on the market if they're looking for more immediate help?
No. No, I think they should find a time machine and go back and kind of erase what they did in 2019. I wasn't high on the Kyrie Irving, Kevin Durant signings.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, we talked about this on the podcast. Yeah. I did not feel as though, you know, Kevin's injury is one that's somehow easily managed. No. A lot of people were basically just putting it up as, oh, well, KD's going to come back and he's going to be the same guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't know that. Like, this is an Achilles injury at the age of 30. Like, that is significant. And he's on a massive contract. Kyrie, for all the talents, for all the charisma, whatever you want to call it, what he has,
mm-hmm.
Like, he is still a very volatile character in many senses. He's not a natural leader. He can divide a locker room. And I'm still flabbergasted that he got elected to the players' union. Like, what was that about? I think the owners are absolutely loving that. I think they love this, because if there's a guy who can somehow split a room, it's Kyrie. And I think he could happen to do that with the players' union itself. I would not have gone that route, but oh, fine. No, I think they were onto something good. They had Dinwiddie. They were looking at LeVert, giving him an increased role. Jared Allen is awesome and fantastic. Yeah. They had a lot of young guys. And instead, they just went all in on, you know, Kyrie, KD, and DeAndre Jordan. Like, a lot of these past prime players now... You know, not Kyrie and KD necessarily, but DeAndre Jordan is. Like, he's a fake stats guy at this point.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they're trying to do. Even if those guys come back healthy next year, like, what's the realistic top potential that they have? Is it championship? Because they were built as though they wanted to compete for a championship.
Right.
I don't see this team beating Milwaukee.
Right.
I see them having significant troubles with Toronto, if Toronto stays together for another year. Mm-hmm. Even Philly, if they figure their things out, they're going to give them a fight.
Yeah,
like, Indiana could even beat them. I'm just not there with the current roster construction of the Brooklyn Nets. So when you ask me if they should be willing to move their young guys, they probably are, but they shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
I would trade Kyrie in a nanosecond.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're going to have some tough decisions this summer, because those guys are not signed forever. I mean, they need to capitalize on this window. I think they were both 3+1 deals, if memory serves correctly. So they're going to have basically a 2-year window in which they're guaranteed to have these guys under contract. But yeah, they have some tough decisions to make in the meantime about, is this the right supporting cast around them? Like, can LeVert, Dinwiddie, Kyrie all play together? If not, do we need to trade Dinwiddie or LeVert for someone who's a better fit around them? How does KD fit into this mix? Can we count on Kyrie? Like, are we sure that Kyrie Irving is going to make it to the playoffs healthy next year?
No, and not just in terms of health. You can't trust Kyrie on a personal level. You don't know where his head is. And I'm not even trying to make a joke on it. I mean, I am being completely honest when I say you just don't know where he is in terms of his headspace. And I feel for him. I feel for him because I think this is I think he's a thinker. And I think being a thinker can be a good thing. I also think it can be a very, very bad thing if you don't streamline your thoughts. Yeah. Kyrie is a guy who's all over the map. He confuses his teammates. He confuses the media. I suspect because he's confusing himself at times.
Yeah.
I think his presence can be such a distraction. I'm saying that's fully knowing that he is like so talented right now, you know, not knowing in which iteration of Durant is coming back. Right now he's probably the most talented guy on the team. And that is not something that should just be ignored,
right?
But being able to use talent productively and being a leader are two vastly different issues. And he masters the talent level but has no idea how to be a leader, has no idea to be a teammate. I mean, I would rather have Spencer Dinwiddie as my point guard than I would Kyrie Irving.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you know, Ben Gordon, that Players Tribune piece that came out the other day.
Oh, that was heartbreakingly good, if that's a term.
Yeah, but it made me think, like, if I had to pick one current NBA player it made me think of, like, my mind immediately went to Kyrie there.
Same here. Same here. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's...
And that's just like that is not us saying that Kyrie is out there. Like we don't know. We don't know his mental situation. I mean, we're not psychologists. Like we were just saying that it's problematic, and he's shown a couple things this year, especially that that long statement about needing help and throwing his teammates under the bus. That he's doing things once in a while that just appears completely illogical.
Yeah, yeah, like totally counterproductive. So yeah, I mean, I'm not saying this Nets thing is definitely going to fail. For all we know, Kyrie's going to come back healthy. KD's going to be, if not 100% of what he is, maybe he's 80 or 90%, but maybe that's still good enough, and maybe they are the best threat to the Bucks next year. But
and that would be great.
Yeah, for sure. But I think you're right to say, like, you know, if I'm looking ahead right now, I can't say with any confidence that they're going to be the second or even third best team in the East next year, which is not what they wanted coming into this season. Like when they signed Kyrie and KD, they thought, like, all right, punt on this year, fine, we're legit championship contenders come 2020-2021.
Right. Do you trade Caris LeVert?
I mean, I think in general, I think that's what's going to be the big story of the offseason. Not just Caris, but like trades in general, because the free agent class sucks so much and the draft sucks so much. But like, I think trades are the one way we're going to get some spicy action.
Yeah.
And I think there are going to be enough teams out there, especially given what happens in the playoffs this year, that realize what we have currently isn't going to work. Mm. Let's do something else. But hey, if the Nets need another center, if they're not satisfied with just Jared Allen and DeAndre Jordan, and they want to get rid of Kyrie, Al Horford is very lightly used. In fact, the Sixers are reducing his wear and tear at the end of the season by benching him and only playing him 20 minutes a game. So I'm just saying, Sean Marks, get on the phone with EB. Let's make something happen, baby.
I am sure that Kyrie, Ben Simmons, and Joel Embiid will go over like gangbusters.
It would be a great they would have to bring Brett Brown back just because no other coach, anyone would be like, you want me to coach who now?
Yeah. Well, on the subject of shortly the Sixers and injuries, so Vogue has, of course, tweeted. And before we started the podcast, we were saying Vogue is definitely going to tweet a Ben Simmons update while we're recording. And lo and behold, he did.
Great.
After a lower back injury on Saturday, Ben Simmons underwent initial evaluation in Philadelphia today and will undergo further testing tomorrow, league sources tell ESPN. He'll be out for Monday's game versus Atlanta.
Lovely.
So, yeah, that's a wait-and-see approach, which is fine. Yeah, we can go into Simmons on the next podcast because that's a weird situation. Unfortunately, Vogue didn't stop there. He's got news. Oh, Jaren Jackson Jr. has a sprained knee and will be reevaluated in 2 weeks.
No! I'm much more upset about that.
Yes, I am too. Memphis are really doing things right now. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Damn, that sucks. Well, we talked about, I think it was the last pod where we talked about second half storylines and how Memphis had the toughest schedule in the league for the rest of the season. So that is bad news for anyone hoping to see them in the playoffs, but hopefully he'll get back in there healthy soon enough.
Hopefully as well. This means a little bit more minutes to Jonas Valanciunas, who I want to see be unleashed just a little bit more. I love that man. I can't help myself.
And we'll get some Brandon Clark. More Brandon Clark.
And more Brandon Clark, exactly. And that means potentially more shot attempts for Ja Morant, which I'm always down for.
Yeah, I'm not mad about that at all.
Nope. So, like, if they can pivot positively, go for it.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Mort, let's wrap up with some news that has been years in the making at this point. This happened, so All-Star Weekend was in Chicago, obviously, and I thought, in general, like, I don't remember most years, I feel like they don't incorporate the city as well as they did this time.
Right.
Like, the whole All-Star intro was just, like, about Chicago, and it was common rapping about, like, if you were from Chicago. That was awesome. Maybe it's because I lived there for a couple of years, and I will remain fiercely loyal to Chicago, but that was great. Not a banner weekend for the Bulls front office, however, as Zach LaVine, believe he went on First Take, some ESPN talking head show. And as he was there, fans started chanting Fire Garpax in the background, which was probably not what you want when you're the host of the All-Star game. Then there were a couple reports. There are a few reports. Casey Johnson of NBC Sports Chicago, I believe Joe Cowley of the Chicago Sun-Times, also reported. Basically, the Bulls are considering shaking up their front office. They're going to potentially demote Gar Forman, the current GM, to just a complete scouting role. Casey Johnson said they're looking for, quote, an empowered presence in the front office. I know Ricky O'Donnell of SB Nation, a friend of the podcast, went scorched earth when he saw these reports because he said, like, basically, no, this isn't enough. You can't just demote Gar Forman. And I think they were going to keep Paxton in place, right?
Is the correct plan? They were probably going to move him up in more of an advisory role, but still someone with significant input.
Yeah. So Ricky was basically like, no, burn this thing to the ground, fire both of them. More obviously, you have had some opinions about Garpax in the past, but where do you stand now, knowing they're considering making changes? What do you think they should do here?
Well, I think it starts at the top in terms of understanding what kind of culture needs to be implemented first and foremost. Mm-hmm. You need to you can't just say, let me start it over. Basically, you're saying we need changes. If you do that, if you come to the realization that you need a change, it's because something has gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then you have to identify what exactly went wrong. If we believe that there are certain people who in charge who are responsible for that, we need to evaluate, should we keep those guys on board to the same extent? And here's the thing with Gar being moved to a scouting role, that might actually work in some sense, because if his sway over the organization isn't as strong as it used to be, which there are also reports about, like, okay, if he's in the scouting department and he's not, his opinion on roster moves and on chemistry and all that isn't taken into consideration, that would be a change. Then it comes down to John Paxson. Where does John Paxson stand on, hiring an external guy coming in to take over the day to day? Is he going to be supportive? Is he going to be a guy who micromanages? Those are the things that you as an organization would have to ask yourself. You would have to have a sit down with Pax as well and go, look, if a guy comes in what kind of power do you give him? Do you give him power to do things whereas you can't interject, or do you need to have the final word? If it's the latter, then you just have to ask yourself, why even make changes? Because you're here for a reason. You're in this situation that you're in for a reason. You need something new. That means a new voice, and that, not just a new voice, but someone who can actually get things done and who have the authority to get things done. If you remove the authority from that new guy coming in, whoever it might be, then it will ultimately prove fruitless.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a fair way to think about, you know, kind of where the Bulls stand at this point. I know I haven't read the column yet, but I saw someone from, I think it was The Athletic, tweeting about Jim Boylan, some frustration mounting with him in particular as well. So let's say you take over the Bulls right now, and you have control over their front office, coaching staff, roster. What do you do to get this franchise back on track?
Well, first I start, again, I understand that it's going to sound boring, but I start with the culture once again. What I do is I implement a more friendly atmosphere, because for years the Bulls have been known as somewhat of a hostile environment. Back in the day, there were, you know, a lot of rumors about, you know, offices that were bugged, literally. I don't think those rumors were ever substantiated, but just the mere fact that they were out there means that there was severe distrust between, you know, players and management and all that. So you need to correct that first and foremost. How do you do that? Well, it starts with trust, right? It starts with building a relationship. It starts with doing things as a front runner instead of being someone who reacts to things all the time. Like Adam Silver, for example, came out a year ago, maybe a little less than a year ago, and talked about how players are lonely on the road. And he went into, like, some of them are even depressed. Okay. Let's say I get hired, or I'm at a job interview with the Chicago Bulls. I'm hoping that one of the first five questions that I'm getting asked is, how do you make sure that our players and our coaching staff and everyone, you know, that we employ are happy and satisfied and don't feel alone? And, like, how are you going to be a front runner in changing, you know, this negative trend of players being sad, lonely, depressed, whatever? And, you know, look, I'm not sitting in that seat, so I don't right now have an answer at ready. But I know that was something I would think about. I would think of ways to try to improve that. I would try to improve morale. I would try to make sure that players who come to practice and who come to games are, you know, have this feeling of being there as welcomed additions, that they're happy to be there. I want happy employees. That's first and foremost. I would personally get rid of the punch clock, or, you know, the punch-in clock. I think, you know, I understand what Jim Boylan went, you know, tried to do. I just think it's horribly backfired. I know for a fact that a lot of players hate it, and think it's really, really demeaning. So that's what I would get rid of. And I would look at my entire coaching staff, and I would look at the executives, and I would go, who here shares my vision of actually having a progressive franchise that thinks ahead of the curve and thinks about what's best for players and make it a positive environment? The people who aren't inclined to agree with me on those things, I would move them out or reposition them elsewhere. Additionally, I would expand my scouting network to a global, you know, I would actually install the largest scouting network of any team in the league, I think. I really would, especially because of the finances that the Bulls have. They earn a ton of money every single year. They're consistently one of the, you know, most profitable franchises in the NBA, yet they have one of their smallest, the smallest scouting staffs in the entire league. And kudos at least to them for recognizing, hey, you know what? We need to upgrade in that capacity. That's also been a thing. I would basically make sure that I'm scouting everywhere, including Denmark, man. Even Denmark. I would scout everywhere to make sure that nothing comes as a surprise to me. I would make sure that my pro scouts are some of the best in the business, because when I consider making a trade or a free agent acquisition, I don't want to be surprised. You know, I think the Jabari Parker fiasco is a pretty good example of that. Like, I think it's fair to say that everyone knew that wasn't going to work, yet right. the Bulls insisted this is going to work, and it did not. And part of that is just not knowing the person that you try to sign. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously, you have to understand he's not a small forward. He doesn't right. have the speed. He's strictly a power forward in today's league. And the way that they utilized him on the court was not suitable for you know, optimizing his game. Mm-hmm. Additionally, he's a gunner. You have to understand who he is as a player. He is a guy who you get in to take and make shots.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas your plan of last year was to make sack that kind of guy. It right. just didn't compute. So again, it's logical decisions, it's reasoning, it's debates, it's having discussion, trust, all these buzzwords that everyone kind of rolls their eyes at but are so crucial in NBA, mm-hmm. you know, in NBA circles. You need yeah. to have a wholesome organization, and you do so by talking and making sure that everyone feels safe and feel happy and feel heard. And right now, I think it's fair to say that I don't think the Chicago Bulls are an organization that have those attributes.
That was so surprisingly tame compared to your past rants that I am very proud of you for. Yeah. Just, I mean, this, but I think that's the right way to, like, you know, you can go in guns blazing and say, we need to tear down the whole franchise, you know, build from the ground up. Like, sure, okay, but put that into place. Like, what are you actually trying to do? Are you trying to trade your entire team and start over completely? Are you trying to get rid of every single employee in the Bulls? No, like, you know, you want some changes at the top, of course. I understand that frustration, but no, they have some pieces in place. In terms of the roster, more, I mean, injuries, of course, have been a huge storyline this year. Otto's out. Right. Wendell's out. Laurie's out. Do you think they need to make substantial changes in that regard? I know you've done a complete 180 on Zach LaVine, and you are, like, very pro him moving forward. But do you think, you know, these other young guys that they have are keepers, or is the jury still out on most of them just because of all the injuries?
No, I think the jury is still out in some respects. I think there are some people you can identify, or some players you can identify and say, well, that's probably not going to be a long-term thing.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, I think it should be, there should be a rule with the Bulls now. No longer should you, in the draft, select one-way players.
Mm.
This has been an unfortunate theme for them for years, with one of the rare exceptions being Wendell Carter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even going back to the Doug McDermott fiasco of 2014, you know, that was a one-way player. I'm not sure what they thought the upside was in McDermott.
Mm-hmm.
Denzel Valentine, strictly offense. And you just have so many of those guys. Kobe White right now, like, I want to give him credit for at least trying on defense. I don't think he's got good defensive fundamentals. I think he's been, unfortunately, very, very poor in that end of the floor.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to give him credit for trying. The thing is, he's always going to be way more of a scorer than he is going to be a defensive game changer.
Yeah.
So moving forward, especially going into the 2020 draft, like, go for someone who has the potential to be a two-way player.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what you need moving forward. The current climate of the NBA proves that the teams that win always have plenty of two-way players. Yeah. That is one of the key ingredients in creating a championship roster. You need two-way players. So does that mean trading Lauri Markkanen? Well, it depends. It depends on what you put next to him. Mm-hmm. Like, if you pair him up with Zach LaVine, then you have two guys in the starting lineup who aren't great defenders, but who can definitely, you know, get the ball moving offensively, at least if Lauri Markkanen is being utilized correctly and he has his own, you know, trust level. Reports are that he's very, very, you know, hard on himself, to the point where it's actually reached a point where he's lost a lot of motivation and trust in himself, which is mm-hmm. unfortunate. But yeah, you just need a streamlined roster. Yeah. And as for me, you know, changing my pace, I was actually thinking about it a little bit, because, like, you're right. I spent years just basically doing like Ricky did and mm-hmm. flamethrowing. And I'm realizing, I think the best way to actually attack this is by helping the Bulls instead of just criticizing them all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, they need help in terms of understanding how a roster and a team is being built. And that's not being facetious, and that's not being, you know, me looking down upon them. It's just clear as daylight, and we have so many examples of that this in recent years. They are way behind the curve. Mm-hmm. They have no level of understanding, unfortunately, and not at this point, of how to be a progressive NBA team in 2020. And, you know, the Bulls themselves might disagree with me on that, and that's fair. They can do so. But I think looking at the results is proof enough.
Yeah. Well, I'll take, when the Sixers get knocked out in the first round this year, I will take your place as the flamethrower and go scorched earth on them instead. How about that?
That's fine. I'm okay with that.
Okay. All right. Well, in that case, that's a good place for us to wrap up here. Thank you all, of course, as always, for listening. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're now being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, Brian.